Welcome to the podcast version of Sunday Miscellany, which differs from the radio version for rights reasons. We hope you enjoy the programme.
Most working days, I cycle my late father's High Nelly bicycle into Croke Park. Despite the architectural modernity of the stadium, the vintage bike fits comfortably in its environs and rests easy there. I brought the bicycle to Dublin following my father's death in 2011, the year I started working in Croke Park. Much like my father, it is a rare specimen, even by the norms of rare things, and twice I have been stopped on Dublin's busy streets by enthusiasts seeking a closer look at its distinctive crossbar design. As a birthday present, a friend sent it to be fitted out for a new front brake set to a mechanic known for vintage bike restorations. He dated it to about 1913, the year the Gaelic Athletic Association purchased the grounds on which Croke Park now sits. The bicycle forms part of the GAA mythology. Before the rise of the automobile, the Freedom Machine enabled our games to spread beyond neighbouring parishes and allowed youngsters see in the flesh the intercounty stars that before resided soundly in the airwaves and purely in the imagination. They returned to great prominence and importance during the Second World War, when fuel shortages saw a generation return to the saddle to keep our games pedalling. A cursory exploration of the GAA Oral History Project, commissioned by the Association as part of its 125th anniversary celebrations in 2009, reveals amongst the 790 interviews conducted with GAA fans, players and administrators, an assortment of references to our great emancipator, the bicycle. The humble bike also provided past generations with a boast second only to claiming the All-Ireland title itself. I cycled to Dublin to watch that game. I have heard that declaration from men from the four provinces. For swathes of the population, the GAA serves as an almanac, marking their calendars as accurately and as emotionally as their children's birthdays. When your working life too synchronises with its seasons, milestones appear both on the horizon and in your rearview mirror with heartbeat regularity. But some, such as the anniversary of Bloody Sunday, caused your heart and head to pause. I was cast back to my 10-year-old self, the sports-mad boy sitting distractedly in national school, waiting for history to end so I could escape again outside to play. I recall hearing how 14 of those who attended a game in our national stadium never lived to kick another ball or see another match, including Tipperary player Michael Hogan. I realised that I was the same age then as Jerome O'Leary, the youngest victim of the massacre, who was shot in the head and killed. You appreciate that history is not just a thing of the past, but something that shines a light on your understanding of your world, your identity and our games. I ponder a lot of things when I'm cycling. Coming up Clonliffe Road and watching Croke Park emerge over the rooftops of the street's red brick houses and cottages, I wonder how many of the 5,000 spectators that made it to Croke Park on Sunday, November 21st, 1920, journeyed by bicycle. A fair swathe, no doubt. It was the tail end of the golden era of cycling in Ireland, and Croke Park had even hosted bicycle races by then. A match between Tipperary and Dublin, two of the top teams of the era, would have seen country roads and city streets deliver processions of elegant High Nelly riders to Jones's Road, their individual journeys ending in a collective destination, black swans arriving unwittingly to a black swan event. Michael Collins was a good man for the bike. My brother Ollie restored as a wedding present for my wife a beautiful Rally High Nelly, built according to the serial number in their factory on Hanover Quay, Dublin in 1947. He accompanied it with a framed copy of the famous photograph of the big man standing proud beside his Rudge Whitworth bike, custom made in 1919. For a revolutionary, it was an ideal mode of transport in a city awash with comparable bikes. One could dissolve into a crowd or fleetly flee from the scene of an assassination, finding oneself in minutes on the other side of the city. The Freedom Machine remains the only way to traverse this historied old city. When travelling by bicycle, you are part of your environment, cultural and built, rather than looking at it through yet another screen. It offers immediacy, intimacy and connection. My jaunts around the city and to my office in Croke Park involve less subterfuge than those made by the big man and his 12 apostles. The only revolutions are off the cogs and wheels, or in my mind. Nonetheless, as I slip from the outside world and freewheel up to the staff bike rack buried deep under the Hogan stand, I remember that there is more to this place than just a name.
On that Sunday in late November, the sight of a small spotter plane circling the Croke Park pitch at Jones Road caused concern to my father Jack Shoulders and the other members of the Volunteer Dependence Fund Committee. They had organised a charity football match soon to take place there. They had received a visit that morning from officers of the IRA Dublin Brigade, sent by Michael Collins, warning them to expect a raid by Crown forces. This would be a reprisal for a series of actions taken early that morning in the south side of Dublin City, in which 14 British intelligence officers had been killed. My father, who was then secretary of the GAA Leinster Council, was asked to liaise with the Fund Committee. In a statement given to the Bureau of Military History in 1952, he said, "The match had been fixed some weeks in advance. The teams taking part had been selected from counties Tipperary and Dublin, and I was in charge of the arrangements. We were rather unfortunate in the date selected." After the warning from Michael Collins' people, he continued, "I consulted with GAA officials present, including Alderman Nolan, Luke O'Toole, Andy Harty and Dan McCarthy. They considered that if we called it off, the GAA would appear to be identified with what happened the previous night in Mount Street. Raids anyhow were common, but we never anticipated such a bloody raid. Though anxious about the outcome, we decided to carry on. Stylesmen, ticket sellers and ground staff had been appointed and the gates opened about 1:30 or 2 p.m. The game was not in progress more than 15 minutes when lorries of the raiders swooped down on the grounds and without any warning burst the way to the railing surrounding the playing pitch, opened fire on the people on the far side and on the players. Fortunately, they were scattered and only one of them, young Hogan of Tipperary, was shot dead. The other players threw themselves flat and managed to crawl off, mingling with the crowd. Many were tumbling over the wall into the waste ground on the Ballybock side. It was among the spectators on this side that the greatest havoc occurred. 15 people of both sexes were killed, hundreds wounded or injured in the mad scramble that followed, trampled or torn with barbed wire on the walls. Dad went on to describe his own predicament that day, saying, "I had my little office under the old stand, but vacated it when the shooting started and mingled with the crowds, with armed forces all around. Searching went on for an hour or more, the people having to keep their hands up with machine guns trained on them. Not more than 4 or 5 were detained on suspicion. I was one of that number. A small diary was found in my possession, which appeared to a drunken officer searching me to be suspicious, and he ordered me to be detained in one of the dressing rooms to be dealt with later, which did not look too healthy for me. Sometime later, another officer came along, fortunately a decent and sober man, examined the diary and said out loud that he didn't see anything suspicious here, and quietly to me, 'There has been enough bloodshed here today, and I'd advise you to get away as quickly as you can.' I obeyed the order with alacrity. I was the second last to get away, and the last was a young lad released after me. What pleased Dad most, however, was that during the following week, all but £5 of the total gate receipts of £165 was handed in by the ticket sellers to the benefit of the Volunteer Dependence Fund. What would surely have pleased him more, were he alive to see them in a revitalised Croke Park, were events such as the record crowd of 90,000 for the 1961 Down versus Offaly All-Ireland football final, the Special Olympics of 2003, the fantastic Ireland versus England rugby match in 2007 when the huge crowd respected the God Save the Queen anthem, and Queen Elizabeth's visit in 2011, heralding a new spirit of Anglo-Irish reconciliation. What a remarkable panoply of events the greensward of the old Jones Road ground has experienced since that dreadful day when blood flowed on Sunday, November 21st, 1920.
It was spring 2007 when Bloody Sunday started to reel me in. I was working for the Sunday Times, reporting from Croke Park on the Ireland-England rugby game that drew so much commentary at the time. This was the English rugby team in Croke Park, an English flag fluttering on the breeze above the stadium, and God Save the Queen echoing around the same place that witnessed the killing of 14 people by police on Bloody Sunday, 87 years before. The papers were full of Bloody Sunday back then, but a lot of the stories, they didn't fully make sense. The number of the dead ranged between 12 and 16. The names of the dead were different depending on where you read them. Was the match at Croke Park that day between Dublin and Tipperary an All-Ireland football final or an ordinary old challenge game? And what did we actually know about Michael Hogan himself, the Tipperary player killed on the field and our most cherished sporting martyr? Our ideas of what happened in Croke Park on Bloody Sunday had been framed for decades by history books and film and really painted black and white. But all these conflicting stories in 2007 suggested something different. It sat with me for 4 full years. The story was there, lost in family memories, autopsy reports, eyewitness accounts, inquiry reports, newspaper cuttings, all scattered across the decades. And the result was a book called The Bloodied Field that came out in 2014. That should have been the end, but very quickly during that process, the work of establishing the names, details and circumstances of the shootings gave way to the real power of Bloody Sunday, the stories of the victims themselves. For nearly a century, the massacre at Croke Park had been reduced to a single image, Michael Hogan. We never knew the list of the dead included an ex-British Army man, Michael Feary, whose body lay unclaimed for 4 days. And we knew nothing about the 3 children killed or Jane Boyle, the woman due to be married that week, buried in her wedding dress. And most of all, we never shared and held the trauma suffered by the Bloody Sunday families themselves. Theirs was a silent grief, their stories lost through the cracks. For years, the families curated the memories of their relatives like relics. The family of Tom Ryan, mortally wounded, whispering prayers into Michael Hogan's ear on the field, kept a tiny pocket Bible from Tom's coat pocket that day. After the body of Tom Hogan, the 19-year-old from Tankerstown near Kilmallocken, County Limerick, was brought home, his family cleaned the blood from his coat, stitched up the bullet hole, and kept it safe for 100 years. In 2015, 8 victims out of 14 lay in unmarked graves. Some of the families in 1920, they couldn't afford a headstone. Others were afraid that a headstone might draw attention and prompt reprisals from the local police. And some wanted to wait until the fighting had stopped to erect a headstone on their terms, telling the story of their relative's death in their way. And that story is being told now. The GAA's Bloody Sunday Graves Project has helped erect headstones on 7 unmarked graves in conjunction with the families. On August 12th, 2016, Nancy Dillon came to Glasnevin Cemetery as the last surviving daughter of a Bloody Sunday victim to see a gravestone unveiled for her father, James Matthews. Nancy's mother was 6 months pregnant with Nancy when James died, already struggling to raise 2 young daughters in the tenements of North Cumberland Street in Dublin. After the death, she couldn't stay in the house or anything, Nancy told me that summer. I hadn't the sense what she was crying about. I didn't know what tragedy was. I don't think she ever got over it. And when she'd cry, I'd cry. In 2019, 3 headstones were to be erected that November. One of them was for Jerome O'Leary, a 10-year-old boy shot from a wall as he watched the game. But Jerome had no family left now. I got a phone call from Cian Murphy in the Croke Park press office that autumn, a driving force behind the Graves Project and the returning of the victim stories to the centre of Bloody Sunday. He asked me to confirm Jerome's name for the headstone, his age, his address in 1920, and to say a few words about Jerome's life at his grave. It was 8, maybe 9 years since I had sat in a newspaper library in London, scrolling through spools of microfilm, when the face of a young child with long crimped hair appeared on a page of the Daily Mirror. It was Jerome, the first forgotten Bloody Sunday victim I had ever seen. Now I was standing by his grave, granted one of the privileges of my life to honour Jerome's memory. The stories of the Bloody Sunday victims and the deeper understanding of what brought them and such chaos to Croke Park is their gift to us. Our gift to them and to their families is to listen and to remember.
My father was a player on the Tipperary team who played in Croke Park on the 21st of November 1920. My father told the story. The day before the match, the Tipperary team were travelling to Dublin on the train. Because of his activities in Tipperary as an active volunteer, my father was a wanted man. He was the only volunteer, along with Michael Hogan, on the Tipperary team. He was quite sure that when the train arrived in Dublin, the British would be waiting to arrest him, but they weren't there. On arriving in Dublin, my father made his way with Michael Hogan to Phil Shanahan's pub. Shanahan was a well-known Republican sympathiser. While in Shanahan's, he was asked by D.P. Walsh, who was an IRA man from Feathered, to transport revolvers and ammunition to Fleming's Hotel in Gardiner Street. They were to be used the following morning by Collins' squad to assassinate British intelligence officers. Dan Breen sent a message to my father on the morning of Bloody Sunday to return to Tipperary with him to help set up a flying column. He advised my father not to play in the match that afternoon. However, my father ignored the advice and played. On the day of the match, my father was the designated place kicker. He was about to take a place kick when an aeroplane appeared overhead and dropped a red flare. My father never got to take the place kick. The black and tans and auxiliaries were positioned outside Croke Park. The flare was a signal for them to attack. They opened up with machine guns and rifle fire. My father, being a volunteer, immediately threw himself to the ground in an effort to avoid being shot. Quoting from his memoir, recorded in the military archives. Six of us, Hogan, myself and four of the Dublin team, including the Sinnets, threw ourselves on the ground. I suppose it was our voluntary training that prompted us to protect ourselves by lying down rather than by rushing around. From where we lay, we could see sparks flying off the railway embankment wall, where the bullets struck the wall, and we saw people rolling down the embankment who presumably were hit. There was general pandemonium at this stage between the firing, people rushing around and general panic amongst the crowd. Hogan, whilst running from the field to the paling, got hit by a bullet. I think Josie Sinnott and myself were the last to leave the field. While running to the paling ourselves, I saw a soldier loading a round in the breech of his rifle, and he appeared to be looking in my direction. I dropped to the ground and a youngster near me fell, which I took to be a shot which appeared to be intended for me. After jumping over the paling, I got into the crowd. I made a dash across Hill 60, now known as Hill 16, and got out of Crow Park over the wall. My father made his way to a house on Clonliffe Road. He was there only 10 minutes when the door was forced in by British soldiers. He was the only member of the Tipperary team wearing tricolour socks, which his sister had knitted for him. When the soldiers saw the socks, they bayoneted them off him and stripped him naked. They wanted to shoot him there and then, calling him one of the Tipperary assassins. My father maintained afterwards that the British thought that members of the Tipperary team had been involved in the assassinations that morning. A British officer ordered the soldiers to take my father back into Crow Park to be assembled with the rest of the team to be shot later. As he was being marched into the grounds, a man offered him his coat, whereupon the man was rifled by a British soldier. The team were lined up against the wall with a firing squad in front of them. However, the commander then informed the Black and Tans that he would take responsibility for them. They were marched back to their dressing room in Crow Park and searched. They were later released, and my father stayed that night in Stevenson's house in Seville Place. He returned the following Wednesday to Tipperary to attend Michael Hogan's funeral. He then became a full-time volunteer on the run from this time on until the truce, and subsequently became a lieutenant colonel in the army. My father was Tommy Ryan, and I am privileged to be the only surviving son of a player on the Tipperary team who played that day on the 21st of November 1920.
At 9 o'clock on a Sunday morning in November 1920, Percival Smith answered a knock at the door. His father wasn't dressed yet, so Mrs. Smith sent their son. He was 10 now, old enough for such an errand, and it would only be a messenger because no one else would call so early when the house wasn't properly up. One man stayed with the boy in the hall, while 9 more rushed in by him. The boy heard shouting, shooting, screaming. He watched the men push their way out, and then he saw his first sight of violence. His father, Thomas Smith, dying, the lodger, Donald McLean, dead, and a visitor, John Caldow, badly injured but alive. The same knock, the boy answered, was heard at the same time at many other doors, at addresses in Dublin, at flats, boarding houses, at the Gresham Hotel. Within minutes of those knocking sounds, 19 men had been shot. 14 of them died that November 21st, and a 15th perished from his wounds on December 9th. The dead were British intelligence officers, or so the IRA said, but some, like Percival Smith's father, were clearly not. Although more were meant to be killed that morning, the day's killing still wasn't done. In the afternoon, Crown forces retaliated by firing into the crowds at a football match at Croke Park. More than 60 were injured, and 14 more people lost their lives. 100 years on, we know a lot about the day that came to be known as Bloody Sunday. But with the release of the military service pension applications, of 7 of those 10 IRA men who went into Percival Smith's home on Moorhampton Road, we can see something of what they thought of their Bloody Sunday, and if and how Bloody Sunday left its mark. Jack Young was dead by the age of 21, fighting for the National Army. He didn't even make it to the worst of Kerry's Civil War. No work took Daniel Finlayson to New York, where he made a living painting houses, but he drowned swimming off Long Island during one warm July holiday at the age of 32. Their Bloody Sunday was just something later mentioned in the hope of getting their dependence and allowance. When asked by the pension board in December 1935, "What did you do on Bloody Sunday?" James Byrne replied, "I was in charge." When pressed, he said, "I put 3 men up against the wall and plugged them." Whether such a euphemism was easier to utter than some of the other possible words, we will never know. But Byrd got his pension and complained it should have been more. Edward Devitt felt the same. His application suggests regret, not so much for what he had done, but rather for what life after had not gone on to become. Michael White, with the same anger at his own poverty, compared his position to John Caldow's fate. He wrote, "Cadlow lived with 9 bullets in his body. I believe he received £5,000 compensation." White was mistaken, mistaken about the number of bullets, the surname and the sum, but something was clearly being weighed up and found wanting in the balance. "I lost a lot by fighting for my country," his letter finished. John O'Donnell and James Norton both spent time in Grange Gorman Hospital and both believed that Bloody Sunday was the cause. Norton wrote to the pension board, "I was 20 years of age in November 1920. He said that he was personally responsible for all that happened in the presence of their screaming wives and children. He died in 1974 after most of a lifetime in Grange Gorman's wards." A referee for John O'Donnell's pension application connected the year O'Donnell spent in hospital to Moorhampton Road. An incident occurred, the referee wrote, with one of the children in the house, which later played so much on his mind as to cause the trouble from which he suffered. The incident referred to was that of the child who begged of him not to shoot Daddy. O'Donnell had waited in the hall with Percival Smith, and because O'Donnell was haunted by those words, we hear at last the voice of the 10-year-old boy, the boy at the door, the boy all those years of trying to fathom Bloody Sunday hasn't taken much account of. I wonder, do we want to hear him now?
The real meaning of Bloody Sunday lies not in grand historical narratives, but in the personal pain and the legacy of trauma of those who were bereaved. How did Jerome O'Leary cope with the death of his 10-year-old son, also called Jerome? Young Jerome was murdered as he sat on a wall behind the Canal End goal, watching the early stages of the match. His body was later identified at the Mater Hospital by his father, who said simply, "He was a schoolboy." How did Bridget Robinson cope with having to go on a Sunday evening from her house on Little Britain Street across to the old Drumcondra Hospital where her son William lay? William had been sitting in a tree watching the match when a bullet ripped into his chest and out through his shoulder, throwing him to the ground. He fought to survive, but he could not be saved. Bridget Robinson herself was just 29 and her dead son was 11. How did she cope? And how did her husband Patrick cope with having been in that hospital as a surgeon fought to save the life of his son? The events of Bloody Sunday in Croke Park quickly took on a national historical significance which eclipsed the suffering of the bereaved. This is what ordinarily happens in time of war. The roll call of the dead is absorbed into a conflict. Death becomes another thing to be fought over. And once that happens, reclaiming truth becomes much harder. What happened in Croke Park on Bloody Sunday passed into the story of the Irish Revolution. it became a key reference point, justly presented as evidence of the brutality of the British regime, of callousness and cruelty, of disregard for the lives of the mere Irish, and all compounded by the crass denials and cover-ups that inevitably followed. It was the ultimate indictment of empire. Naturally, Bloody Sunday also became a touchstone in the history of the GAA. In independent Ireland, the legacy of Bloody Sunday included a real and genuine desire to remember that 14 people had been killed at a Gaelic football match. The naming of the Hogan Stand, after Michael Hogan, the Tipperary player who died on the field, and the subsequent unveiling of plaques, were rooted in a sincere sense of loss. But Bloody Sunday also got absorbed into the GAA's own history in a very particular way. It became utterly bound up in the GAA's identification with nationalism. More than that, it also became something that could be thrown at the GAA's rivals. For example, in Waterford in 1931, in the middle of a dispute between the GAA and soccer, the chairman of the Waterford GAA County Board, Willie Walsh, asked where the Rugby Union, the Soccer Association or the Hockey Association were on Bloody Sunday. He noted that the Black and Tans had not gone to Dalymount Park or to Lansdowne Road to look for rebels. Instead, it was to Croke Park, he said, that they went and performed deeds which shocked the civilised world because they knew friend from foe. The backdrop to this insult was the enduring desire of many in the GAA to imagine that it was in the vanguard of the Irish Revolution. The reality is much more complex. For instance, after the 1916 rising, leading officials of the GAA had actually negotiated with the British commander in Ireland, General Sir John Maxwell, in an attempt to arrange for the provision of special trains to GAA matches. On top of that, many GAA members had fought in the British Army in the Great War. But these facts did not fit the new cartoon history of goodies and baddies that was being created, and so they were ignored. And all the while, the lives of those who were bereaved were lived out as this new history was built around them, stripped of complexity and somehow sanitised of the raw grief of bereavement. But it is this grief that ties the day together. It unites Jerome O'Leary and Bridget Robinson with the family of Patrick McCormack, who had been shot dead by Republicans in the Gresham Hotel on the morning of Bloody Sunday. He was an innocent horse dealer, shot in an apparent case of mistaken identity. In the rooms of the Gresham, it was said that the amount of blood was particularly shocking. It soaked the carpet in deep crimson pools. The blood of Bloody Sunday flowed freely through the day, and its legacy left an appalling stain on the lives of too many people. It is in this remembrance, in the raw truth of grief and irretrievable loss, that the true meaning of war can be found.
I often wonder what life my granduncle Mick Hogan would have led if he hadn't travelled to Dublin for the football match that crisp November day. He was just 24 when he walked onto the pitch, and he never walked off. He was among 14 shot and killed in Croke Park on the day that would become known as Bloody Sunday. The event always seemed to me very distant, part of a national history, yet the discovery of a small paper box while clearing out the family homestead this summer brought home to me the heartbreak that's part of my family history. Neatly wrapped in brown paper and tied with string, the small box of envelopes and letters kept by Mick's mother Margaret was like a time capsule stored for the future. The beautiful penmanship, the empathy and the eloquence shone out across the century from the now browned and yellowed writing paper. In the days after Mick's death, the letters arrived to our farmhouse nestled in the shadows of Slieve na Mon, outside the village of Grange Mochler, County Tipperary. I found them as I was clearing out an old chest that had stood for decades in the hall of the farmhouse where Mick and his six siblings, including my grandfather Paddy, had grown up. They lay neatly stacked between some well-thumbed old Western novels. The letters depict the final minutes as the young man lay dying on the pitch. The game was underway and Mick Hogan and Dublin's Frank Burke were going for the ball when the black and tans suddenly appeared and began firing. There was panic as bullets thudded and whistled everywhere in the packed grounds. On the pitch, the players ran for their lives, but two lay on the ground. They both wore the colours of Tipperary. Mick's friend and teammate, Jim Egan, who had hit the ground beside him, stood up, covered in his friend's blood. He called to a priest he recognised, Father Patrick Crotty, who happened to be from a nearby village of Mullinahone. Another man also lay nearby. Thomas Ryan from County Wexford is believed to have gone to comfort Mick when he was also shot. The priest tended to both men. One of Mick's brothers, Tom, wrote home to his mother to tell her he had spoken to Father Crotty. His last words were a prayer, as you know. When Father Crotty reached Mick as he lay on the field, a nurse was bending over him and said to Mick, "They have murdered you, but they cannot kill your soul," wrote Tom. Tom, a Christian brother, would go on to become well known in GAA circles, and to this day the All-Ireland Colleges Gaelic Football Championship is played in his honour. Father Edward O'Brien from Clonine, near our homestead, wrote to Mick's mother to tell her, along with Father Crotty, he had administered the last rites to Mick on the very spot where he fell. "I got no small shock when I realised that the young man whom I had anointed was practically a neighbour of mine," he wrote. One of the more poignant letters came from a family friend, Margaret Baby Brown, who later married the politician Sean McEntee and went on to become a university lecturer. The letter recalled how Margaret's brother Moss stayed by him where he lay on the field until the ambulance came. "Poor Mick's death, while playing a game, has created a terrible horror, and all Ireland are in sympathy with you today," she wrote. "I'm sending you some of poor Mick's hair. I cut it off in the hospital and I thought you would like to have it." Another of the Brown family, Father Patrick Brown, better known in later life as the poet and academic Monsignor Padraig de Brún, wrote how he had identified Mick Hogan at the military inquiry to spare his brother Tom the ordeal. He recalled how he travelled to Kingsbridge, now Houston Station, alongside the team to see the funeral cortege leave. "I can't keep from crying myself, even still. I remember like yesterday, the first day he came to school, when he was only barely able to talk." The letters and cards contained an outpouring of sympathy and captured the turbulence of the times. W.B. Power, a Christian brother from Drogheda, wrote that Mick had not died in vain, as it is from the blood of such martyrs that patriots spring. The secretary of the nearby Sinn Féin Club wrote of Mick, "Physically a giant, he was as simple as a child. Earnest and sincere, he was amiable, jolly and cheery. A good sportsman, a great Gael, a sterling lover of the motherland, a loving son. What more could he be? Long, long shall we miss him." Some wrote simply to wish Mick's mother the strength to bear the heavy cross. News of the tragedy reached County Tipperary relatively quickly, yet his mother was still unaware of what had unfolded until the priests were wired and requested to travel up to the house to break the news. The loss of Mick was felt deeply, as he was the one working the farm after the death of his father only 2 years earlier. With a heavy heart, the eldest in the family, Dan, an active member of the IRA, travelled home for the funeral. Hiding his gun under a blanket, he was picked up from the station by their neighbour with his horse and trap. After the loss, he recommitted himself to playing a prominent role in the volunteer movement and subsequently the Free State. After Mick's body was released, thousands are reported to have joined the funeral procession, with Clonmel train station surrounded by members of the RIC and Black and Tans. Family have often said over the years that the coffin was fitted with a glass lid to allow his mother, his family and friends a last glimpse of the player, who was laid out in one of his teammates' jerseys. That afternoon in Croke Park was a symbolic day in the War of Independence, but ensured our family's history, that of the GAA and the country, were forever intertwined. Today, my family, the community of Grange Mokler, and I are proud to keep Mick's memory alive. We remember him with honour and respect, and all the dead of Bloody Sunday.
Oh, all the money that e'er I spent, I spent it in good company, and all the harm that e'er I've done, alas, it was to none but me. And all I've done for want of wit to memory.
God bless.
That was a Sunday Miscellany special programme on the theme of Bloody Sunday 1920, first broadcast in 2020 with the support of the GAA Museum at Croke Park. The scripts this morning were The Revolution of Wheels and The Wheels of Revolution was by Colm Regan. The Sunday of Blood, November 1920, was by the late Chris Shouldis. Reflections on the Bloodied Field by Michael Foley. My Father, Tommy Ryan, was by Anthony Ryan. Voices from Bloody Sunday Morning was by Anne Dolan. Grief and History by Paul Roos. And Letters from Mick was by Louise Hogan. The music this morning, Broken Bicycles by Tom Waits. The Battle of Aughrim was played by Mary McNamara on concertina. The Wounded Hussar was played by Anna Ludlow on fiddle. Sleave Gallan Bray played by Liam O'Flynn on tin whistle. Benjamin Britten's Cello Suite No. 3, Opus 87, Street Song, that was played by the London Symphony Orchestra and conducted by Yanadi Rajdiezvinsky. Billy's Death from Billy the Kid by Aaron Copland, also performed by the London Symphony Orchestra and conducted there by Anton Durati. And The Parting Glass, sung by the Clancy Brothers and Tommy Makeham live at Carnegie Hall. Sunday Miscellany's broadcast coordinator is Elaine Conlon and the producer is Sarah Binchy.
You've been listening to the Sunday Miscellany podcast. For more from us, you can follow the programme on Facebook, Twitter, Spotify or Apple Podcasts. Just search for RTE Sunday Miscellany.